You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Nationals reporter, Jamal Collier. Jamal, time to talk about the outfield as far as this Nationals team goes. And when you think about the moves that the Nats have made during the offseason, obviously the outfield is a big part of that with the addition of Adam Eaton and obviously also moving Trey Turner from that center field spot that he had late last year back into the infield. But let's start with Eaton. Seems like the logical place to start. They gave up a lot to get this guy. Obviously, that adds some pressure. I'm not sure what kind of guy Eaton is as far as handling that pressure or even considering it pressure. But when spring training starts and all the reporters around and we get closer to the season, is there going to be about as much attention on Adam Eaton as anyone on this roster?
Yeah, it's a good point, actually, that, you know, you talked about just the price that they pay, and it's also just so unusual for the Nats to pay that price. You know, they're kind of usually a little reluctant to give up their prospects. So for him to go and identify a guy with Eaton, who a guy who has been a very good player, yes, the last 3 or 4 years, but he's a guy who's never been an all-star, never won a major award. And it kind of just, you know, shocked people. You know, that was the price they paid to get a guy like Andrew McCutchen or somebody with kind of a more of a proven track record or a proven kind of list of accolades. I don't think people would have kind of batted an eye. But, you know, for Eaton, the numbers necessarily don't all jump out to you to think that this is the kind of guy that you would pay so much for. But there's going to be a lot of eyes on him to see exactly was it worth it. And it's going to be tough, and obviously, like, you know, people will want to judge that deal right away, and you know, based off what he does this season. But the Nats like this player a lot. They like the things that he's done the last 3 or 4 years, and they think he's a guy who's getting better, a guy who's going to be consistent and be able to kind of put those numbers up every single day, every time he goes out there. So a lot of eyes going to be on Adam Eaton, but they're really not concerned about how he'll respond to it, because you look at the last 3 years, and the on-base percentage has been there, the WAR has been there, everything has kind of been pretty consistent, and you know exactly kind of what player you're getting. I think they feel the same way about Adam Eaton this year, and they feel pretty comfortable knowing that they're going to get kind of what they paid for here.
And you know what you're getting. You mentioned it offensively. There's a consistency there. There's been that constant WAR where he's really been solid. I guess the biggest question mark goes to the defense, because here's a guy who is a gold glove right fielder, but that's a little different than center field. And when you look back on his time in center field, as far as metrics go and advanced numbers, they don't smile as much upon Adam Eaton as far as his work in center field. So, to me, it's something where if a guy is that good in right field, he's got to be able to still get it done in center field. Is it just a matter of him getting more comfortable out there? Or, I mean, I guess, what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I've actually talked to some people from the Nats department, and now it's you know, scouting analytics department, and that's kind of a similar thing, is that when you look at the right field numbers, even the first year, 2014, in center field, and he's got very positive metrics in both of those. In the right field, necessarily isn't center field, obviously, but at the same time, it's not like we're comparing third base metrics to outfield. You know, they are somewhat comparable. So you look at a guy who can play outfield, who's got the arm, who's got the range to do it. And then there's some things about 2015 when he was not very good in the outfield. He was also playing injured. And, you know, the extent of that injury at the time kind of wasn't necessarily all revealed. But, you know, there were times where he talked about he couldn't necessarily even sit up or sleep straight, just because of how bad his shoulder, I believe it was at the time there. So, you know, how much that hampered him or hindered him, you know, kind of played a role in those numbers in 2015. But, you know, will he be, at least for me looking at it, I don't think he necessarily will be an elite center fielder out there, but I think he still has a really good chance to be above average, at the very worst average. I don't think he's going to necessarily be a bad center fielder out there. You know, just there is that kind of uncertainty to see exactly what this guy's going to give you on defense. But they feel pretty comfortable looking at those 2 good years and just the kind of athlete and the arm that he has, that they think that he could, you know, get into that, fill that center field slot just fine.
And he may not be the long-term answer in center field. Obviously, there's a prospect on the way, Victor Robles, who's more of a pure center fielder, I think. And at some point, Jason Wirth obviously moves on. And it seems like that's the logical move, is to eventually get Adam Eaton to a corner, but that doesn't help him in 2017, where he's definitely going to be the center fielder. We'll see how he can get things done out there. But they did well late last year when Trey Turner was kind of learning on the job. So they can certainly deal with some mistakes out there, I'm sure. All right, so that's center field. You move to left field, and I just mentioned Jason Wirth. He's getting up there in age, obviously. How's his range, and how much is going to be on Adam Eaton to help fill the left center field gap?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Jason, at this point, like you said, it's just somewhere at best an average defender, maybe, you know, a little bit below on some days. Early on this season, I remember last year, he just really and he was still adjusting. And that's one thing, actually, he's mentioned, as a matter of fact, he's been a pretty much career right fielder and kind of made the full-time change to left field, which, you know, kind of on the surface doesn't feel like much. But there were times where he was pretty honest about how, you know, left field, you're getting a lot of guys who are pulling the ball, you know, the right-handed bat. And it's just a different, you know, different read for him for guys who played right field when everything's kind of tailing away from him. Everybody's kind of hitting the ball, you know, off the end of the bat and it's kind of going toward the foul line. So it just took him a little bit to just kind of get more and more comfortable. You know, late in the season, like he did look a lot, you know, better, a lot more comfortable out there. Still not great. He's not going to be a Gold Glover at this point in this age or anything. But, you know, he's a guy who I think if they get an average, you know, average from him out there defensively, they'd probably take at this point.
The good news for Worth in 2016 is 143 games played, which is a big lift after obviously missing so much time in 2015 and the numbers really taking a hit. The batting average, .244, on-base percentage, .335 a year ago. He did hit 21 home runs, though, so the pop's still there in the bat. Where do you envision Worth settling into this lineup?
He's really interesting. I mean, you know, about a year ago or a couple of years ago, kind of we were ready for Worth to kind of fall off and not necessarily sure what it was. And it was a guy who just been kind of been injured. And he's the guy with aspirations that he takes care of himself and is healthy and is one of the most kind of conscious about those things, about his body, possibly on the entire team. This is also a credit to Dusty Baker, the fact that he got to 143 games. That Dusty was really cautious with him and playing him and resting him on days, even when he necessarily didn't need rest. Or if there was one thing that might have, you know, a nagging injury or something that hampered him, Dusty would necessarily give him a couple of days off just to kind of not push it. So, yeah, with Jason, you know, he's still a bit of a question mark. Obviously, when you get to 38, 39 like he is, you know, you have to kind of monitor, you know, expectations for him a little bit. But he's a guy who was, you know, somewhere around league average for them last year and at times better. And I think if they get that from him, you combine with the rest of their lineup in a way it looks, they take it. So, you know, right now with Worth, he's not going to be the guy to carry this team or the guy to hit in the middle of the order and do some of the things he did earlier in his career. But he's still showing that he's got some stuff. He's got something left, something in the tank, and he can definitely be valuable and have something to offer for this team at the plate and defensively as well.
And you obviously get the leadership factor with Worth as well in that clubhouse and what he's been for this team over the years. All right, to right field and obviously Bryce Harper, coming off what, I mean, just a disappointing season all around after a Most Valuable Player award in 2015. Across the board, the numbers down a year ago. And part of that, I think, is dealing with the adjustments of everything. But what stood out the most to you as far as maybe just surprising you at what he struggled with in 2016 after dominating baseball the year before?
I think with Bryce, the thing that surprised me the most was how often he there was a lot made about, you know, him being pitched around or him necessarily, you know, people not pitched to him, which is true. People necessarily did not attack that guy based off what he did last year and based off what he did in April. But what surprised me late in the season was kind of how often he would get a pitch, whether it be a mistake or somebody decided to challenge him with a fastball, and he would miss it. You know, it would be whether he would just swing and miss, he would foul it straight back, he would do something with those balls, or where you look at where that ball ended up, or where you think that ball is going to go 400 or 500 feet to the Bryce Harper that we kind of got used to in 2015 in the first part of last year, and that was to me was surprising. I think it's part of the reason also people kind of have continued to speculate whether he necessarily hurt, because those are pitches that he just did not miss as frequently as he did, you know, for that really last year when he kind of really struggled for the most part in the second half. But, you know, I think that was the thing for me that stood out the most, that there were mistakes that he was pitchable to and kind of let people get away with those mistakes sometimes last year that I didn't think he necessarily happened as frequently in 2015.
Obviously, the skills are there, and this is a guy who's entering just his age 24 season, which is still amazing to me. So you figure maybe nobody could be helped more from an off season and just getting away from it all for a little bit, maybe from a mental standpoint, than Harper.
And that's the thing. I mean, it just seemed to all kind of just spiral a little bit where, you know, at some point it becomes a slump, and then the slump lasts into July or to August, and then and then we're talking about what's wrong, and now do you make a day? You know, it just, things just kind of kept snowballing on him. And a guy who would be able to get away from the game a little bit to relax and have a normal off season and work out and train as hard as he does, I think it's something that I really expect a big bounce back out of Bryce next year. He's just got too much talent, too much skills, and we've seen it. We've seen him have the year like he did in 2015. We saw the April he had last year. We've seen him do it for, times in the playoffs. The Giants series in 2014. So it's just, there's too much evidence to me to say, and too much skill, obviously, when he was drafted and coming out of high school, to say that this guy is as good a player as we all think he is, and one of the top, if not two, three or four players in the league, that I would be surprised if he has a year that's closer to 2016. I would expect something closer to what he did in 2015 as opposed to what he did last year.
All right, so there's your starters. How about the bench? How does this play out? Michael Taylor's obviously a guy that's still around, maybe not quite up to what we thought he could be as a prospect, but still a talented outfielder. Chris Heisey's there. Clint Robinson, who is expected to get time in the infield. How does that bench play out as far as the outfield goes?
Yeah, there's probably still some uncertainty with that. As far as who's going to be the fourth outfielder, they re-signed Chris Heisey. They like him a lot off the bench. But he's a guy they like to use in pinch hit situations, like to use him against lefties, a spot start here and there. But he's not necessarily your fourth outfielder that if somebody gets hurt or somebody has to miss, some time on a DL, that he can step in and play every single day. It's just probably not something they want to do necessarily right now. And just in his career, Heisey has not been kind of successful in that role as opposed to the pinch hit role that he's kind of, made a career out of at this point. That's if you look to a guy like Michael Taylor. Did not have a very good season last year and stepped in for Ben Revere when he got hurt at the beginning of the year and really kind of did not seize that opportunity. You think he's going to probably compete for that fourth outfielder spot with a guy like, Brian Goodwin, who was another guy who was a highly touted prospect who dealt with some injuries, kind of was in the minor for a lot last year and really seemed to figure something out and put things together to make to be there in September at the end of last year. And even make a push, he was being considered to possibly make the playoff roster. So, those guys are probably the two leads for the backup outfielder. I think Taylor still has a bit of an edge unless he kind of plays his way out of it, in spring training. But he was also really, really, really good in spring training last year and kind of wasn't able to carry those results over. So a little bit of a question mark. You've got some guys who've got some chances they're going to get an opportunity necessarily to fill that backup outfielder spot. But they don't have a real certainty necessarily as far as their fourth outfielder. So, they're kind of counting on these guys that are there to stay healthy, particularly with Harper and Eaton, to not only be healthy and be two of their most productive players, the two guys who are in their prime, who could play at a 4, 5, or 6 win pace, depending on how well they're going. So, a big thing for Nats, they need these guys to stay healthy and to play as many games as they can.
Great stuff, Jamal. As always, this has been MLB.com Extras, our Nationals edition. For Jamal Collier, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Mets reporter, Anthony DiComo, as we go inside the New York Mets bullpen, getting ready for 2017 spring training right around the corner. And Anthony, 2016 was a great season for Jay Reese Familia. 51 saves. That was a club record. He was one of the better closers in the game. Maybe he tired a little bit down the stretch. He got a lot of work in, but lots of question marks heading into 2017. How much he'll be able to be on the field because of an impending possible suspension. So let's forget the suspension for a second and just look at Familia and what he can bring this team again in 2017 on the field. Do you expect him to be just as dominant?
Yeah, I mean, look, we talked about Lucas Duda at first base a couple weeks ago, and we talked about how so much of his reputation is colored by one play in the World Series against the Royals. I think Familia is kind of the same way. He has 3 blown saves in the World Series against the Royals, 2 of which were really not his fault at all. And then obviously he had that wild card loss to the Giants last year. And I think a lot of that has undermined the fact that this guy has been not one of, but probably the best or most productive closer in the league the past 2 seasons. He has worked as much as anyone around baseball. He set a record. He set franchise records for the Mets for saves. He holds the record among Dominican-born closers for saves now. He really had a magical 2016 season, and a lot of that melts away because of one inning, because of one game, because of what has happened to Jiris Smiley in the postseason. And maybe there's some truth to that, but I think it's overlooking the big picture, which is that Jiris Smiley is a great, great closer and has been for several years now. If there's a question mark to me, it's not, is this guy good in the clutch? It's not, can this guy hack it in the postseason? It's, have the Mets overused him now to the point where he is tiring at the end of seasons? Have they overused him to the point where it's going to come crashing down on him one day, maybe one day soon, in regards to an injury or in regards to just a general fatigue? Because we've seen in the past, relief pitchers in particular, when they're used every day, when they're warming up all the time, when they're getting these gaudy games totals and innings totals, we've seen how we can catch up with them, both on a micro level, you know, within a season, on a macro level, when you have a couple of really heavy workload seasons and then maybe you just can't bounce back the next spring, you just can't bounce back for the next regular season. So in regards to Jiris Smiley, this is all kind of speculation right now, because we really, with the exception of a couple of hiccups, have not seen him fade all that much. We've seen him stay strong. This is a big-bodied guy who, you know, obviously has the velocity there, obviously does everything he can to keep in shape, and has been pretty strong throughout his career. And as long as he continues to do so, or to be so, I don't think there's any doubt Jiris Smiley is going to continue to be a productive closer and one of the best in the league. You know, he has been that guy, and he has shown very few signs of slowing in the past couple of years.
And in an unfortunate way, maybe he will get that extra rest at the beginning of 2017. If Familia's out, and otherwise the setup man on this team is Addison Reed, and if you need a guy to fill in as your closer, seems like a good guy to have. He was really good in 2000. As good as Familia was, Reed was right there a year ago.
Yeah, you could make the argument just based on statistics that Addison Reed was better in 2016 than Familia was. He was out there just as often. He was putting up just as impressive numbers, and that was really, really big for the Mets, especially given the state of their starting pitching, so many injuries, that ability to shorten the game and to really essentially, you know, it was seven innings and it was game over for the Mets in 2016. And we've seen that formula work around baseball throughout the league the past few years and the past few decades. You know, you get multiple lockdown relievers at the end of your bullpen, whether it's two guys like the Mets had or three guys like the Royals had when they won the World Series. You know, it really does wonders for your bullpen. It really does wonders for your team. It really does wonders for your starting staff. And the Mets certainly had that with Addison Reed. You know, this was kind of an unheralded guy coming over from the Diamondbacks on a waiver deal a couple of years ago, and had been so unproductive that year with Arizona that he actually got optioned to the minor leagues at one point that season. And redid his delivery a little bit, worked out some kinks in his mechanics, and all of a sudden, he's developed into one of the best relievers in baseball. He's only going to be more important this year if Jiris Smiley is suspended, because he will be the closer on opening day, if that's the case, and maybe for several weeks. So, yes, maybe that does give Jiris Smiley a little bit of a rest, but it certainly does Addison Reed no favors. The Mets are going to lean heavily on him throughout April and again throughout the season. He is now one of the cogs and one of the rocks of this bullpen, and just like the Mets need Familia to stay healthy and stay productive and stay strong throughout the long summer, they need every bit of that from Addison Reed as well.
After those two guys at the top, there's a lot of other talented arms, but I don't know if there's any defined roles at this point. How do you see the rest shaping up as far as you have a lefty in Josh Edgen? Who's the long guy? I mean, do you have an idea in your head at this point, Anthony? I know spring training goes a long way in setting up a bullpen, but is this bullpen going to be very similar to 2016 in the way the rest of it shakes out?
It certainly looks like it's going to be pretty similar, and the Mets ensured that by not going after any of the top free agents on the market. You know, they said early on, we're not going to pursue Aroldis Chapman or Mark Melancon, Kenley Jansen, those top guys, and even that second tier, the Neftali Feliz types, the Mets largely ignored on the free agent market. And what that does is that ensures that there should be roles for guys like Hansel Robles, who's been of growing importance in this bullpen the past couple of years. Guys like Josh Edgen and Josh Smoker, those lefty specialists, should have a chance at least to compete for jobs in spring training. I think the most intriguing part of this bullpen heading into spring when everyone heads down to Port St. Lucie in a couple of weeks is how do the starting pitchers play a role? Because you've got, really, I would say, four starting pitchers who are locks for jobs at this point, and Matt Harvey, Jacob deGrom, Noah Syndergaard, and Steven Matz. And then you've got three others who we don't know, and that's Robert Gsellman, Seth Lugo, and Zach Wheeler. I think there's a strong chance that at least one of those guys opens up in the opening day bullpen, and they're intriguing for different reasons. Seth Lugo, while he really took off as a starting pitcher last year, came up as a reliever and was quite good in that role for the Mets. Robert Gsellman has certainly on paper better stuff than Lugo, and it's tantalizing to think, you know, if the Mets need an eighth inning guy in April with Jeurys Familia potentially suspended, what could Robert Gsellman do in that role with that power sinker, that, you know, 97 mile an hour, and kind of similar to what we've seen out of Familia all these years with the really hard throwing, hard sink delivery. And then you've got Zach Wheeler, who's a complete wild card in all of this. You know, maybe he makes the rotation. Maybe he can't get on the field because he's not healthy. But the Mets have also talked openly about putting Zach Wheeler in the opening day bullpen to limit his innings, to kind of ease him back from a Tommy John surgery that he has struggled to return from. If he's anything like the Zach Wheeler we saw before surgery, with that really, really incredible stuff, that upper 90s, breaking pitches and the whole package, what could that look like in one inning spurt? So the Mets are definitely going to have some decisions to make in spring training. They're going to have to look at all of these guys, and those three in particular, both in starting roles and relief roles. It'll be very interesting to see how this all shakes out and which of those guys, because I do think it will be at least one of them, which of those guys ends up in the opening day bullpen.
You're right. Wheeler certainly fascinating. And when you think about the coming off the surgery, if you could limit his innings early on, then if you need him to move into the rotation later, he has the firepower to be able to do that, and you're still going to be able to hold his innings down. And then you know what you maybe have as a bullpen guy when you get to the postseason and you don't need as many starters. It would be nice, I guess, to have a feeling for what Zach Wheeler could maybe bring you in the postseason going back to the bullpen. Makes a lot of sense to me. I agree with you as far as Zach Wheeler, at least for some period of time, pitching out of the bullpen. This is certainly a good problem to have if you're the Mets. And when you look around baseball, there's a lot of teams that have good rotations and lack a bullpen. There's teams with great bullpens that maybe lack the depth in the rotation. This Mets team has it all, Anthony. And I would think when you look as far as a team over the long haul of a regular season with their rotation and what they hope it will be and this bullpen depth, the total package is there to really have a nice season if you get the offense.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, because of the injuries and because of the signing of Yoenis Cespedes and the work the Mets have done their offense, it's easy to lose sight sometimes that this is still a team that is very much built upon pitching. And in particular, it's built on starting pitching. But the Mets have had a pretty nice bullpen the past couple of years. And, you know, another thing I think is important to remember is that Sandy Alderson does not love going out and spending on relievers during the offseason. We've seen that this winter. We've seen it in winters past. But what he does like to do is supplement it and add to it once you see what you have over the course of a season. 2 years ago, he brought in Addison Reed, which was huge for the Mets both in 2015 and in 2016. Last year, he brought on Fernando Salas, who was really quite excellent for the Mets down the stretch. And there have been some misses as well over the past couple of years. But I think Sandy Alderson has shown this pattern now. If the Mets are in contention, he will go out, and that's one area that he will look to add to and to supplement to during the middle of the season. So the bullpen you see on opening day for the Mets is highly unlikely to be the bullpen that you will see for the Mets in August, in September. And that's how Sandy Alderson likes to build his bullpens. And look, it's worked. This has, again, been, well, not an elite bullpen over the past few years. It has been above average, certainly, and in many cases, one of the better groups in the year, and it all goes back to the back end. Jeurys Familia, Addison Reed, if those guys are healthy and pitching well, this will again be a good unit in 2017.
Great stuff, Anthony. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Mets edition. For Anthony DiComo, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here with MLB.com Marlins reporter Joe Fusaro as we continue to break down the roster the Miami Marlins are putting together heading into 2017. And today is infield day. I guess we'll just go around the horn, Joe, and that starts at the hot corner. Martin Prado is back. It's in a situation where obviously late in the 2016 season, he signed that extension, a time when you don't necessarily normally see that kind of thing happen. But obviously this is a matchup where this team loves having him as part of it, and he's happy to be a part of the Marlins.
Yeah, Tim, this was, you know, when you look at all their offseason moves and you kind of are going to measure it from the Volquez signing, the Ziegler and Tozawa and all the pieces they added, this is probably their biggest offseason move, and people kind of forget that because he was, you know, one of their own. But the Marlins, you know, clearly prioritized all last year, Tim. There were talks going on before any of us really were even reporting about it, but you knew, you know, mid to late in the year, that retaining Martin Prado was their number one offseason priority. And when you know, look at it all, 3 years, $40 million, the richest contract of any free agent that they got. So retaining Prado is part of their offseason move and a huge one. I mean, obviously the team was really struck with a terrible tragedy at the end with the passing of Jose Fernandez. And Prado really, you know, as if he wasn't already, you know, he really stepped up as kind of the spokesman for the team. I always call him kind of the unofficial captain of this team. Don Mattingly, even the last game of the season, allowed when a lot of the bench guys played at Washington, he allowed Prado to actually manage the team that day. And, you know, he kind of went out and made a pitching change even in that game. Prado, highly, highly important to this team. And when you look at the numbers in 16, highly productive. Led all National League third baseman in hits. In batting average, 305 batting average, 183 hits, struck out the fewest number of times of all third basemen in National League, just 69 strikeouts, and he drove in 75 runs and hit eight homers, not a ton in terms of the power there at the corner, but Marlins Park is not, you know, the kindest to hitters of Prado's, the way Prado's approach is in terms of knocking the ball over the fence.
Also, I was actually surprised. I think of Martin Prado as being a guy who's been around the game forever at this point, Joe, but this will just be his year 33 season. I mean, he's no youngster, but I always think of him as being already mid-30s to pushing late 30s. He's still right there and has some baseball left in the tank.
Yeah, and that's why it's a three-year deal. And I do think this, though, Tim, you have to be careful with him, how you're using him. So he's going to be spelled from time to time, you know, to keep his production up. It's not ideal for him if he's running out there 155, 156 games or whatever, you know, because he'll break down. So I think part of Don Mattingly's approach with Prado to maintain his production is to kind of give him some days off and kind of coach him along and spot him along to keep him as fresh as possible, so he could hold up over a long year.
Moving over to shortstop, and Adani Echevarria really had that breakout season a few years ago, Joe, but a step back in 2016, the batting average way down at .236, the on-base percentage below .300. Now, he's never been a big on-base percentage guy, but that was kind of a low point as well. He makes some spectacular plays at shortstop, but do you expect a bounce-back year from Echevarria in 2017?
It would really help the team if it was. I mean, yeah, you know, you're kind of reading that flash line from 16, but in 15, he actually was pretty productive,
right,
with a .281 batting average, .315 on base, .374 slugging, and that's hitting in the eight hole. You know, so obviously National League, the eight hole isn't ideal for big, big numbers, but you expect them to be better than .236, .283, .311. So, and Tim, I think it affected his defense last year. I think he carried his offense to the field. Wasn't as good as the 2 years previous. He was a Gold Glove finalist, didn't win it. But, you know, to me, you're a finalist, you have every, you know, you're right there, obviously. So I think Echevarria, this is a big year for him. And, you know, from the terms of the Marlins looking to keep him, you know, even longer term after this. So, you know, he obviously a very athletic player. If he doesn't show a little bit more, this could be the end of the line for him as a Marlin. So I think there's going to be, you know, some incentive for a better year. And, you know, I didn't write it in my story. I don't have the numbers offhand, but he, you know, when in the advanced metrics, the hard contact, his hard contact was about the same in 16 as it was in 15. The Marlins did take that in consideration and said, look, you know, the 16 numbers maybe is a little bit unlucky as well, because he did hit the ball pretty hard. And we'll see if that translates, if he increases production at the plate.
And then when you move over to second base, D. Gordon, obviously 2016, hurt by the suspension. He was able to come back late in the season. But when you look at him going into this year, obviously there's going to be a lot of question marks, Joe, because people are going to wonder, hey, is the reason he was so productive in 2015 because of the PEDs, and what can we expect from him in 2017?
No question. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people looking at D, and I think if there's going to be a player on this team with a chip on his shoulder, you know, wanting to prove that, you know, obviously when you hit 330, that isn't something that happens all the time, but obviously at this high mark, and, you know, when you won the batting title, what, 333 2 years ago, and then, you know, he failed that test last spring training. And I really do, you know, looking back at him and kind of, he is a very energetic person and, you know, a guy that really loves to be at the park. But you can see mid-spring training on that there's something wasn't right. And then he got slapped with that suspension the end of April for the failed test in spring training. So, you know, I think he knew what was coming, and I think it affected him. So, you know, how he did that whole year in 79, keep in mind he played, what, 79 games, and he sat for 80. You know, in terms of that half a year suspension. So there's going to be a lot to prove. And as you note, you know, the eyes are going to be on him to see, you know, if D is more of the player a couple of years ago or not. If the Marlins could get a 300 season out of him batting average wise, I think the on base will be good enough. Clearly, if this team is going to take off and have any chance this year, a productive D Gordon at the top of the order, being disruptive on the bases, making things happen in what I think would be a pretty good offensive lineup, even, you know, they finished, what, third to last or whatever, and run scored last year. But he is going to be one of the central players on this team, and to see if he, you know, can be the player he was when he was an all-star in 14 and 15. So it's going to be a big year for D. Gordon, and see how he bounces back and, you know, if he could remove some of the suspicion people might have if 15 was a little bit inflated and not natural.
Yeah, and Gordon, I mean, obviously they're going to need him at the top of the order, like you said, and disrupting things, stealing bases. What they need at first base, Joe, is power, I think. When you talk about Justin Bour, obviously he was having a breakout season a year ago when he got hurt and he missed all that time. So like Gordon, there's going to be questions, hey, who's the real D. Gordon? I think people want to know, was that the real Justin Bour that we got a flash of, a guy that can really swing the bat and that can hit home runs in Marlins Park before the injury? Can he be that guy? And then after that, I guess the question will be, can he do that every day, or is he going to end up being a platoon guy?
Yeah, no question. When you look at last year when things started to go wrong for the Marlins, it was when Bour, you know, hurt his ankle in Atlanta in early July. At that point, he had 15 homers, 46 RBIs in 68 games. And he finished the year with, you know, I don't think he didn't hit another home run the rest of the way, drove in a few more runs after he came back in mid-September. They're going to need Justin Bour. I mean, it's a very talented defensive infield, very athletic infield. At first base, Bour is, you know, not that Gold Glove caliber player as they have at the other positions, but they're going to need production, as you note, and power, because there's not any real power in that infield besides Justin Bour. So he's a guy who, when he was hitting that stride, as you saw by July before the injury, he's starting to pull the ball, elevate the ball, and easy power. I mean, second deck homers without big swings, and the guy will draw a lot of walks as well. Obviously, keeping him on the field, you know, one of the reasons they wanted him to slim down last year at this time was to, and, you know, hopefully in their mind, keep him more durable, keep him on that field. And, you know, the Marlins right now do not have that complement right-hand platoon option. He is not in camp right now, and he may not be. And Don Mattingly has said he wants to see if Justin Bour, who has never really hit left-handers that well, can play every day and face left-handers with the occasional day off. So big year for Justin Bour in terms of a guy that is going to have a lot of eyes on him as well to see if he is an everyday guy. And if he's one of those guys that could be, you know, highly productive in helping, you know, protect Stanton and everybody else in that middle of the order.
Then when you look at the bench as far as the infield goes, Derek Dietrich obviously did such a great job at second base last year when D. Gordon did have to serve the suspension. He's one guy. Then you have Miguel Rojas as well. How do those guys fit in as far as playing time and what positions do they get the most time at?
Yeah, it's they got two really good ones, I think. You know, very good depth in the infield in that regard. You know, if they go with a four-man bench especially, you know, you're going to be looking at these guys playing everywhere. You know, Derek Dietrich can back up at first base. Now he's a left-hander as well. But, you know, he's a guy that can play there if four needed a day off or two against a right-handed, you know, pitcher. And, you know, he could play some third as well and back up D at second base. And he plays a little left field as well. So Dietrich can drive the ball to the park, left-handed hitter who has a knack for getting on base. Defensively, he makes the plays that are right at him, and that's really what they're asking for. And Miguel Rojas is one of those interesting guys that, you know, he's that super utility guy as an infield. He's their best fielding first baseman. He's close to, you know, the numbers may not completely suggest it, but he is close to that type of guy at short, behind Echeverria. Now, keep in mind, he's also playing third, second, and first, so he's not just doing it every day, but a guy who has familiarity with Mattingly dating back to L.A., and then Mattingly really liked him and even started playing him over Echeverria at times when he was hitting a little bit better at stretches than Etch last year. So, to me, Rojas is your late-inning defensive replacement at first base. He's your, you know, kind of 1B shortstop, and he could play second and third at a pretty high rate as well, but may get less time there because Dietrich could fill in both of those spots as well.
So it's a good, if you're going to, you mentioned it, if you're going to go with that extra reliever, you have to have the guys that make that possible to be able to play all over the diamond, and the Marlins have that, which would make that interesting, and that's certainly going to be a fun thing to watch, how they handle that bullpen and this roster as a whole, because going with one less fielder in the National League is also a little bit more complicated than doing it in the American League, where there's a few less substitutions to have to worry about as the season goes. Great stuff as always, Joe. This has been MLB.com Extra, our Marlins edition. For Joe Fusaro, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here along with Mark Bowman, our MLB.com Braves reporter. We continue our look inside the Braves roster heading into the 2017 season and spring training, which is quickly approaching out at Disney World. And we're going to focus in on the outfield today, Mark. And it's an outfield that fairly veteran, or if not very veteran, group heading into 2017, which isn't true of most of this roster. But when you talk about Kemp and Ciarte and Markakis, there's a lot of baseball in those guys. Let's start with Kemp, because obviously he came over late in 2016. And you look at the total numbers for the year, and it's really remarkable. The home run totals, 35, 100 RBIs on the season. I mean, this is a guy who we kind of got a glimpse of the Matt Kemp we used to see play for the Dodgers.
You didn't really know exactly what to expect the day the trade was made. It made perfect sense. The Braves were looking to dump Hector Olivera's contract or whatever they could get him, because they were going to eat it. He was never going to play in Atlanta. And obviously the Padres were willing to not only, you know, to eat that salary, just to save some from what they were paying Matt Kemp. And you heard some of your West Coast colleagues, what are the Braves doing, you know, or whatever guy they saw there in San Diego over the last couple months, they questioned why the Braves would even do this. It's not the same guy we saw. I mean, this was, like you said, he doesn't have the legs he did the year that he finished second at the NL MVP. He's gotten in better shape this offseason. But at the same time, that bat was still there. And it was it wasn't just that production that he provided. They just needed a right-handed presence right there in the middle of that lineup. And that simply, Freddie Freeman was doing some pretty incredible things before Matt Kemp arrived. But just having him sitting behind him, you know, added to his success, enhanced the value that Nick Markakis had behind him. And, you know, Matt Kemp's presence is a significant reason why that offense finished second in the league and runs per game over the final 2 months, you know, second only to the Rockies. So maybe they were first in the non-Coors Field divisions. He's not only that, the significant reason that they performed so well there the last couple months of last year, but he's a key reason why there's so much optimism this year. And it's not just the focus on him. It's just what he does for everyone else around him. You know, what he does for Freddie in front, with Freddie sitting in front of him and with Nick Markakis sitting behind him. But the middle of that lineup is, you know, there's some legitimacy to it, and we haven't been able to say that for a few years here in Atlanta.
Now, in center field, Ender Inciarte, obviously another part of that trade that kind of keeps on giving for the Braves, along with Dansby Swanson, Aaron Blair in the Shelby Miller deal. And all he did last year was provide a pretty good bat, and he has that speed, obviously, and a excellent Gold Glove caliber glove in center field.
Yeah, you see it, with your own eyes throughout the season. Then our StatCast folks, they break it down and confirm everything that our eyes saw. This guy did some special things. I mean, some of the with the glove, and you kind of expected him to provide Gold Glove caliber defense. I think the biggest change for Ender last year, obviously he missed most of the first month with the hamstring injury that he suffered there during the first week. He struggled to get going right there, right before the All-Star break. He started to feel some things, and that was confirmed when he came back after the All-Star break. And, he hits 360 with a nearly 430 on-base percentage, I believe it was. And he provided them a legit catalyst there in the leadoff spot. And, if this guy stays healthy, he can continue to be the key ingredient at the top of that lineup. I think the biggest reason we saw such improvement from him during the second half of last year was the fact that he hit left-handers so well. That was a big concern when he came over. Would he be able to stay healthy? Could he hit left-handers? Well, he had basically a season and a half worth of sample size there based on what he had done in Arizona. That those concerns were created from that small sample size. The one half year of extreme success in Atlanta should also be viewed as a small sample size, but you saw everything this guy can provide, and it made perfect sense for the Braves to extend him in December with the contract they provided. That doesn't, when you're extending an arbitration eligible player, that really doesn't do anything to say they're definitely going to be around for the length of that, but it provides some cost certainty. And when you compare that deal to some of the others that were made this offseason, I think the Braves got significant value when you look at what he provides, not only with his bat, but with his glove. He and Billy Hamilton were both deserving of a Gold Glove last year, but what Ender can do with his arm, I think, is what sets him apart, from the other great center fielders.
When you look at right field, is this job Nick Markakis's, or could there be a little competition there in spring training?
No, this is Nick Markakis's job. What we saw from Nick Markakis, this guy is what he has done. He basically that neck surgery he underwent was basically the same one that Peyton Manning underwent, David Wright last year. There's still questions about David Wright. And when Nick Markakis came back, he was committed. He had that surgery in December. He comes back in April, plays on opening day, and virtually plays the whole season. There's only, over the last two seasons since this surgery, there's only three other outfielders who have logged more innings in the outfield than Nick. And, that's a testament to this guy's character. This guy comes to play every day. And, he had a full off season last year. He was able to get some of his strength back. We saw it. I think he led the league in doubles in April last year. He struggled a little bit at the plate in May and a little bit in June. But, we saw that power start to come back in July. I think this is not a guy that you're saying is going to hit 30 homers or anything like this. But if you equate what he did over the final three months of last season, over the entire season, then, he's once again a 20-homer guy. A guy with something he hasn't been able to do since it became a problem while he was with the Orioles. So, and defensively, the arm strength may not be exactly what it was before the surgery, but we saw a little bit of that come back. This is a guy I think that you can plug in there to play 150-plus games this year, probably closer to 160. And, he brings it every day. He doesn't say a lot, but just his actions speak louder than words in terms of the leadership he provides in that clubhouse. He's a very valuable piece for this team.
When you think about this team and its bench, and it sounds like they're going to go with a four-person bench for the most part, it becomes interesting when you look at the names. Jace Peterson seems like a lock to be on that bench. Then there's Micah Johnson, who's part of the organization now, Emilio Bonifacio, Chase Darnot. Mark, you have all these guys, and they're not all going to have a seat at the table when spring training is all said and done. So what is the likelihood, or what is your best guess at how the outfielders, because these guys, a lot of them can play both infield and outfield, which will be key with a shorter bench. How do you see the outfield reserves kind of figuring itself out?
It's a very good question, and it is going to have to play itself out. Let's just look at it this way. Okay, let's assume at the beginning of the season, Rodriguez gets most of the reps at second base. I think that's a given. Jace will get some time there, and Sean Rodriguez's value is, you know, comes from his ability to move around the field, as does Jace's now. You know, we haven't seen Jace play much third base except in spring training. I've liked what I've seen from him there. We haven't seen him play center field a lot, but yet when he did the one game last year, he had a game-saving catch that, you know, was all over the highlight clips the next day. We've seen him play solid left field. He's a guy that can move around. He's going to be a very valuable piece of that bench. You know, both he and Sean Rodriguez can play center field if necessary. If they want to carry someone else, which I do expect them to do, one of the bench guys will be somebody that you know, really can, you know, or has more experience there in center field. You're looking at Emilio Bonifacio or Micah Johnson getting one of those spots with Bonifacio, probably having the nod, being the early favorite heading into camp. So let's just assume it's Bonifacio and Peterson. Now, if you give that other spot to Micah Johnson or Chase d'Arnaud, you know, Chase was, you saw him do a lot of great things last year early on. He's a guy that they also can play, you know, around the infield and in the outfield. He has more experience there in center field than some other utility players. But at the same time, he just didn't – he struggled with the bat last year. And we're going to have to see if that was a product of just the league getting used to him or the planner's work that bugged him as the season went on. Those guys are your candidates. But you have to take a step back and say, are the Braves being wise going with an eight-man bullpen – and keeping their bench so short, because, you know, there's no way around it, not pinch hitting, you know, once a night in the National League. You have to plan for that. And, you know, you look at that cast of characters that I mentioned, and while they all, you know, Jace Peterson's coming along with the bat, I think that the Braves, you know, could benefit from having more of a legitimate bat on the bench. So it remains to be seen whether they go with that eight-man pen, if they continue to say they will. But when it comes time to fill out that roster and they look at what they have, I'll be interested to see if they alter their plan and try to add another bat to that bench, a guy that they can rely on, whether that's Jeff Rancourt or not. Remains to be seen. All the talks with him have centered around a minor league deal. And while he wants to play in Atlanta, he also is still looking for a big league deal right now.
It'll certainly be a big storyline to follow throughout the spring and into the season as they try to get away, I guess, with having that extra bullpen arm. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Braves edition. For Mark Bowman, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here along with Todd Zielecki, our MLB.com Phillies reporter, as we continue to break down this Phillies roster heading into spring training 2017. And we are getting close. It's right around the corner. Despite the fact that the groundhog saw his shadow, I beg to differ. With all these trucks heading south, spring is right around the corner. We are talking catchers today, Todd. And when you think about this Phillies team, there was a thought process during the offseason early on that maybe A.J. Ellis would be back as a veteran guy, a backup type guy, but he ends up going to Miami. So that makes things interesting as far as this catching position goes. But we know who the starter is. That's Cameron Rupp, and a solid season a year ago. Just talk about what Phillies fans should expect from Rupp in 2017.
You know, yeah, Cameron is one of these guys that seems to fly under the radar a little bit, but he actually had a pretty good season for a catcher. You know, I was just looking at his numbers earlier, and he was fourth among, I think it's 19 or 21 qualified catchers in slugging percentage, eighth in OPS. And you didn't really hear a lot of talk about him last year. And he had a really good stretch in the middle of the summer, kind of struggled a little bit early, struggled a little bit late. But what the Phillies have in Cameron Rupp, I think is pretty good, and it's kind of underrated. And I think it's kind of underrated because of some of the prospects they have in the system. But he's got a lot of potential, and if he can kind of figure out a few more things offensively, you know, he could be even better. He hits the ball hard consistently. I was looking at his average exit velocity. It was 92.2 miles an hour, which was the second best on the team and one of the highest marks in baseball. And as we all know, it's basic hitting, right? If you hit the ball hard consistently, you're probably going to do pretty well more often than not. So he's got some power, he's got some pop, and like I said, if he can kind of work on a few things and get a little bit better offensively, you know, he could be one of the top hitting catchers in the National League, and not a lot of people seem to know about that or seem to think that it's possible, I guess, because everybody just assumes that some of these prospects are going to come up and hit big.
Yeah, and there are a couple of those along the way. We'll get to Jorge Alfaro in a little bit, but Andrew Knapp will obviously be a guy who's battling for that backup spot, I guess. He's the number 11 prospect. The new prospect ratings will be coming out very soon, but as far as when last year's ratings on MLB Pipeline finished up, he was number 11. Put together a solid season in AAA last year, so you would think he's pretty much ready to kind of take that next step. But he's got company as far as spring training goes. Ryan Hannigan, Brian Holliday, and Andrew Knapp. Is that going to be one of the key things to look at in spring training, that competition for the backup backstop job?
Yeah, I think so. And what's interesting to me is this. Pete McCannon said a few times late in the season, referring to A.J. Ellis, saying, I really like the idea of having a veteran backup catcher, somebody that can work with the pitching staff, somebody that can work with Cameron Rupp, because Cameron's, relatively inexperienced. He said a little bit early in the offseason, too, that he liked the idea of a veteran backup catcher. Now, at the winter meetings, Matt Klentak said, listen, while it would be great, at some point we have to see some of these young guys play. I'm totally comfortable with Andrew Knapp being our backup catcher. Of course, that was before they brought in Brian Holliday and Ryan Hannigan. So you wonder kind of what will win out as spring training kind of gets deeper and deeper and as opening day kind of approaches. I personally feel that Andrew Knapp is still the favorite at this point. I do see value in just getting him some big league experience. He's going to be the backup, so it's not going to be a prerequisite to hit. If he can just get a few at-bats here and there, I think that would be more beneficial than him than repeating another year in AAA. And quite honestly, Hannigan and Holliday haven't really put up great numbers offensively lately. So it's not like, you bring up Andrew Knapp and you're going to be losing a lot of offense in the backup catcher position. But, all that said, it is going to be kind of fun to watch two veterans go against a prospect to see who can be the backup, can win that backup job.
Could that be an internal debate, too, despite regardless of how they all play? Just you mentioned how Pete McCannon says he'd prefer a veteran. Klentak maybe cool with Knapp going. Is that going to be something where those guys have to kind of find a common ground during the spring?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. They talk all the time. Like you heard Pete McCannon say a lot late in the season, I need some hitters. And Matt Klentak was a little bit, we'll try to give you what you want, but not exactly what you want. So there's definitely some debate between the manager and the coaches and the front office, not in an unhealthy way, but just, your normal, regular baseball debate. And one thing that I think Pete just talks so much about a veteran catcher is sometimes he's been critical of Cameron Rupp's game calling. He thinks he could improve a little bit more. And I'm sure Cameron, feels the same way, that he could improve a little bit more. But so that is something I think is going to be debated. But again, I feel that Andrew Knapp is going to remain the favorite. That they do need to get some of these younger guys in. And if Jorge Alfaro is going to start the season in AAA, what are you going to have Andrew Knapp be the backup catcher in AAA? That to me, that just doesn't make much sense. So for that reason, again, if Andrew Knapp shows some competency behind the plate and at the plate and at the plate when he's hitting, I think it's going to be his job to lose.
So that is a clean transition right into Jorge Alfaro. He was ranked number 4 as far as Phillies prospects go at the end of last season. He got a September call-up, got 16 at-bats, a couple of hits, struck out a lot, but obviously the important thing there was just kind of getting his feet wet. The Phillies, of course, acquired him in the Cole Hamels deal in 2015. And I know Knapp is also a prospect, but it seems fairly clear that the long-term goal is that hopefully Jorge Alfaro becomes the guy, right? In 3 years down the road, he's your starting catcher?
Yeah, everybody in the organization is really high on him. They think he certainly has the talent to be a frontline catcher. He's got a tremendous, tremendous arm behind the plate. I mean, a plus arm and plus power. I remember talking to Matt Stairs last year in spring training. He says, I've never seen a player have better power during batting practice in my entire career. And, he's played with some superstar sluggers over the course of his career and against some superstar sluggers over the course of his career. I say that saying, and he acknowledged it, like, it is just batting practice, but I've never seen a guy show more power than Jorge Alfaro. So it's just a matter of him kind of making better contact, with the ball. You know, he struck out 105 times last year in AAA. He only walked 22 times. But if he can kind of put it together a little bit more, boy, he's just loaded with talent. And so it's going to be a good test for him this year in AAA. He clearly showed, I think, last year in the limited playing time, that he was not ready for the big leagues yet, that he needed more developmental time. I had a lot of people asking me that, like, well, could he be the backup to Cameron Rupp, or, you know, do you think he'll be up, competing for a job? And my answer is always no. I think he absolutely needs to start the season in AAA. I think he absolutely needs to, you know, play a few months there to kind of work on his swing and see some better pitching. But if he does what he's supposed to do, you know, he's going to become a legitimate challenger for Cameron Rupp. And like I was saying earlier, though, Cameron Rupp is no slouch. People kind of overlook him, but, you know, eighth in OPS amongst qualified catchers, fourth in slugging percentage amongst qualified catchers. So Jorge Alfaro does not have an easy hill to climb. He's going to really have to produce, I think, to knock off Cameron Rupp, because, you know, a prospect is still a prospect until they actually prove it in the big league.
Catching depth is something that a lot of teams lack, but the Phillies have plenty of it, and young guys coming up, certainly a good thing to see as a team is rebuilding. Great stuff, Todd. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Phillies edition. For Todd Zielecki, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.